Herbert, we hebben een exclusief Nederlandstalig interview met Martin van den Brink, de CTO van ASML, in de Technoloog.
Ik denk dat niemand had kunnen bedenken dat wij een van de grootste bedrijven in Europa zouden worden, met het grootste bedrijf in Nederland.
Dat is de drijvende kracht achter de steeds kleiner wordende chips.
Het is toch ongelooflijk dat wij hem mogen interviewen.
En toen hij dat zei, dacht ik van ja, dan moeten we dat bedrijf ook overnemen.
Vandaag
in je favoriete podcast app.
De Technoloog wordt mede mogelijk gemaakt door One Xilium. One Xilium. Building Delight.
De Perestroikast. Een blik op Oost-Europa.
Welkom bij BNR Perestroikast, aflevering 143 van de enige podcast van Nederland die volledig oog voor het oosten heeft en geeft. En de zesde en laatste aflevering van onze zomerserie.
Zes weken lang hebben wij een bijzonder interview met een Perestroikast. Met één rode draad, de relatie tussen Oost en West.
En voor onze zesde Perestroikast reisde de Perestroikast af naar Berlijn. Daar waren we al, Floris. Mm-hmm. Deze keer hadden we een ontmoeting met de Georgisch-Duitse schrijver Nino Haratischvili.
As everyone, I guess I was kind of shocked and touched and sad and mad. And I mean, I don't have any other tools than writing. So it was my way to express my anger and my feelings.
Der Urlaub des Westens ist vorbei. De vakantie van het Westen is voorbij, schreef Nino Haratischvili in de Duitse krant Die Zeit. En dat deed ze 2 weken na de Russische inval in Oekraïne. Eind maart stond dit opiniestuk in NRC. Want Tsjetsjenië, Abchazië, Zuid-Ossetië, de Krim, het Westen liet het gebeuren en stelde er te weinig tegenover, aldus Nino. Mm-hmm. We mogen Nino zeggen.
Jij wel, ik weet het nog niet.
Do I want my comfort and staying in my comfort zone? So I know that people are killed for that. Or am I ready to pay my price?
Ze geeft zelf antwoord, zo hoor je straks. Met Nino Haratischvili spreken we over hoe het Westen zich anders moet gaan opstellen richting Rusland. De tijd van vriendelijkheden zijn volgens haar voorbij.
Vandaag begint de lange weg naar morgen, zou ik bijna zeggen. En westerse landen moeten zich ook anders opstellen richting Oost-Europa, zo zegt Haratischvili. De tijd dat Berlijn, Parijs en Den Haag Oost-Europa de les lazen over Rusland, die is ook voorbij.
Ja, jarenlang waarschuwde Riga, Vilnius, Warschau, die westerse hoofdsteden voor de Russische beer. Maar Parijs, Den Haag en zeker ook Berlijn keken naar de economische voordelen van zaken doen met Rusland. En luisterden zowel niet naar het gegrom als naar de noodkreten.
En laten we eerlijk zijn, het is eigenlijk voor ons in het Westen een wake-up call in slow motion geworden. Want signalen waren er de afgelopen jaren voor ons allemaal eigenlijk genoeg.
Berlijn. We waren er al voor Sascha Mariana Salzman te horen in aflevering 141. Berlijn is de stad die symbool staat voor Oost en West, maar ook voor de huidige en nieuwe relatie met Rusland.
Tijd om opnieuw naar de Duitse hoofdstad te schakelen. Na onszelf in gesprek met Nino Haratischvili vanuit Café Goodies aan de Warschauerstrasse.
Ja, wacht even. Een kleine introductie voor de luisteraars die Nino niet kennen. We hebben het al vaker over haar gehad in deze podcast. Ik was en ben onder de indruk van haar boek Het Achtste Leven, een Georgische familie-epos. En daarna volgde De Kat en de Generaal. En begin november komt in Nederland Het Schaarse Licht uit. Al is de publicatie van dit laatste boek in andere talen overschaduwd door de Russische invasie in Oekraïne.
When I was working on writing this book, of course I couldn't imagine things would come this way, and somehow it's left a kind of bad taste in my mouth.
En nu we toch bezig zijn met introduceren, Geert-Jan, mocht je het inmiddels nog niet weten, alles ten oosten van de rivier de Elbe kan de komende weken, maanden, jaren in deze podcast worden besproken. En dat blijkt maar weer met ons gesprek vanuit Berlijn.
En wat leuk is dat we heel sociaal en democratisch zijn. En abonneer je op ons, zodat je geen aflevering hoeft te missen. BNR Perestroikast. Zoek ons op in je favoriete podcast-app.
Ik ben Floris Akkerman.
Mijn naam is Geert-Jan Haan.
En dit is BNR Perestroikast, de zomereditie met Perestroikast nummer 6.
Thanks for inviting.
So we're meeting here in the Berlin, Warschauerstrasse. Anything special to you or just an easy place?
It's It's more has to do with practical reasons. It's kind of my neighborhood. So
you moved to Berlin
2 years ago.
2 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. How is it?
It's good. It was a tough time because when we moved, I was the second or third lockdown, and I have two kids, and it was quite difficult sitting here. And Berlin in winter, it's not such a nice place. It was like minus 17 degrees and no possibilities to go outside or meet friends. So I left for 6 months to Tbilisi, and that was the solution.
Okay, so you moved to Berlin and then you went out again.
Just for the weather.
Just for the weather, but not only for the weather, of course. And it was a good decision, yeah.
And why did you go to Berlin?
Several reasons, but I mean, I spent like 16 years in Hamburg, and I love the city, and I have a lot of great memories, and it was such an important place for me, and of course a lot of friends, but it felt that it's time for something new, like a new phase, for some changes, and the alternative, it was only Berlin for me. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and I found a really nice apartment, so it was also an important reason to come to Berlin. And of course, I have a lot of friends also here, and I mean, a lot of cultural stuff is taking place here, so mm-hmm. I always had to come to Berlin for working reasons, mm-hmm. even before, so now, yeah.
And you became more and more productive in Berlin?
Nope. No, it's quite a challenge because, of course, I have two small kids, and I think it's like this problem every mother or father has to deal with that, and you have to find a good balance between work mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. A private life. And I also have to travel a lot because when a new book is it's been published like this February, then I have to go on tour and like I have this promotional work to do and readings, and it's difficult. And I mean, for me, it's always easier to left the place where I live and go somewhere completely else, like residences or just like renting a flat somewhere else where I don't know anybody and just be on my own and mm-hmm. focus on what I'm working. And last novel, for example, I spent 1 month in Brussels, and it was a great time because, I loved that city, and I loved that I was not distracted by anything. So I could just like, okay, I've been walking a lot, and then, focusing what was on writing, and mm-hmm. That helps a lot. And I'm always trying to go somewhere else, but it's, of course, it's not easy.
Met al haar persoonlijke ervaringen met Rusland in Georgië en Tsjetsjenië, zoals het zelf zegt, en over heeft geschreven, en later met Syrië en de Krim, zou je zeggen dat Nino Haratischvili de oorlog in Oekraïne had moeten zien aankomen. Maar net als bij al onze andere gasten, of bijna al onze andere gasten, was dat niet het geval.
No, I don't think so. I mean, somehow I could have seen it coming because of my experiences, because of my, relationship to Russia.
You mean what happened in Georgia before?
Yeah, what happened in Georgia, but not only Georgia. Chechnya, for example, mm-hmm. and Syria, and Crimea.
Crimea,
yes. Yeah. all the things are, and all the wars are going on like the last 22, 23 years. Mm-hmm. It's not been something completely surprising, but still, mm-hmm. I did not see it coming.
Er waren wel wat waarschuwingen binnen Europa. De voormalig president van Polen, Wajda Lech Kaczynski, die waarschuwde dat Rusland niet zou stoppen bij die oorlog in Georgië. in 2008 en naar meer zou grijpen. Hij bleef ongehoord, schreef de Poolse premier, huidig premier Mateusz Morawiecki, in een opiniestuk dat deze week verscheen in meerdere Europese kranten. Haratischvili weet wel waarom West-Europa niet wilde luisteren naar de achteraf wijze stemmen uit het oosten.
I think it's been maybe a little bit more comfortable or more, maybe more cozy somehow. And the West, I mean, everyone wanted to believe that Russia has changed and they had like this economical relationships and gas, of course, such an important issue and this depending on it. And I think it was easier not to look at that problems in that way and just like keeping repeating, no, okay, yeah, it's somehow a bit dangerous or maybe it's somehow not quite what it seems to be, but still it's not that bad. And I mean, it's changing a lot and it's changed a lot and I'm really happy about that. But I remember when I moved to Germany, 2003, nobody knew where Georgia is, what Georgia is, or even all the Eastern countries, the post-Soviet countries. And it was kind of like a terra incognita, and it was like everything was Russia. So Germans, even they had this Eastern past, and they have their own history with Russia. Still, I had a feeling that they were not really interested in it. It was somewhere, something gray. Everyone is just like drinking vodka and it's really far, far away. And now it's changed. And unfortunately, the Ukraine has to pay the price for this awakening. But it started to change maybe like 7-8 years before. And somehow maybe it's also like because of some artists, some movies, some books, I don't know, I'm not sure. And people are traveling more and realizing that it's not that far away. And it's quite close.
It 2 weeks after the Russian full-scale invasion in Ukraine, you wrote an op-ed published in Die Zeit and later translated in Dutch for NRC, De Oorlog des Westens is voorbij. Why did you write this piece?
Yeah, I mean, as everyone, I guess I was kind of shocked and touched and sad and mad. And I mean, I don't have any other tools than writing. So it was my way to express my anger and my feelings and somehow say what I could say about that. And yeah.
Was it hard to write or easy?
I don't even remember. It was it didn't took me a lot of time. This is what I do know. It was just like more explosion because I was really mad.
Net als bij het vorige gesprek met Sascha Maria Salzman staat een essay centraal tijdens dit interview. In dit geval dus een essay van Nino Haratischvili.
En we zijn in dit gesprek benieuwd naar de manier waarop de aanbevelingen uit haar essay zijn opgepakt door, in dit geval, West-Europa. Daarover straks meer. Maar eerst, voor wie het gemist heeft, iets meer over dit essay. Wat opvallend is aan het essay is dat het begint met een tragedie die wij in Nederland maar al te goed kennen. Srebrenica 1995. Haratischvili zag de film Quo Vadis Aida en ervoerde machteloosheid en gebrek aan controle, zoals dat nu ook ziet bij de Russische invasie in Oekraïne.
Colonel Karamans, they are killing people outside.
En in dat essay, in het Duits gepubliceerd dus onder Der Urlaub des Westens ist vorbei, zie daarvoor ook de show notes trouwens. In dat essay gaat Haratischvili dus in op de symbolische rol van commandant Tom Karamans.
That was quite inspirational because that was such a good, I mean, like a symbolic situation for what was going on right now. And it was not like a movie anymore, it was so reality. And yeah, I mean, all the issues, of course, I'm dealing with that like my half of my life since I live here, or since since I was born. The relationship with Russia, it's been always a difficult one and always a bloody one and always a painful one. And so I'm always been trying to make like my own analyze and have my own point of view. Still, of course, I'm also a human being, and at that moment I was just like emotional and really sad and mad, because I thought, okay, why couldn't we see it before? Why couldn't we react before? And I mean, gas, nothing on this earth is worse for killing children.
Mm-hmm. You're mentioning this movie about Srebrenica, when the Dutch general, Karamans, commander Karamans, is calling for help, but nobody's there, nobody is willing to help him, or on holidays, or they have an excuse for him. And you see that as a symbol about how institutions like the European Union, the West, United Nations, are not listening to people. And you see this repetition now with Ukraine.
Yeah, there have been also, like, I don't remember, I guess in March or end of February, there have been a great article by a Polish writer, Stefan Twardoch, in a Neue Züricher Zeitung, this Swiss newspaper. I loved that article. And the headline was just like, stop with this Westplaining. And he is relying to this mansplaining. It's a it comes from I think Rebecca Solnit. Yes, she's a feminist writer and activist, and she used it in a completely different context, where men are explaining to women like some issues, because and he takes this word and describes the situation, this Western arrogance and West explaining to East how to deal with Russia or how to react. And I really loved that article, because it's like, it's on a point. And I think it's also my own experience. I can share that and I can rely to, because somehow there is always this, maybe it's also because the European history is always being told, like the common sense was always from the Western perspective. And even I remember when I start doing research for my novel, The Eighth Life, it was because one day I realized that I know the European history much more from the Western perspective. For example, I know much more about like Nazis and so on than about the communists. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of shocked. And it's not only like a Western fault, of course, because the Eastern countries, and for example also Georgia, they never did this kind of analysis. The Germans, for example, of course Germans were also forced to somehow after what happened after Holocaust, after the World War, Second World War, and so on. And in Georgia, the recent history has always been, of course, that people were trying to survive the last 30 years. It's like a big struggle still. So many other problems, and I mean, it's always like this riots and social problems, economical problems, and something is always going on and changing, parties and revolutions and so on. So it's never quite peaceful, unfortunately. But still, we had to do that. We had to, because a lot of things are keeping repeating themselves, because we don't have this analyzed, because we didn't have a look at it. And of course, there are a lot of movies or books about it, but it's not enough. The whole society had to do that. For example, in Germany, every school girl or school boy knows, okay, Hitler, it was a bad guy. And I'm not sure that everyone in Eastern Europe and Russia for especially does know that about Stalin. Yeah. So this is a big mess. And I think a lot of problems that are going on today, they start there. And even after the perestroika and Russia especially, for example, Germans, they always thought, or this is my impression, they thought, okay, after like 91, everything's changed and Russia become a different country, but it never happened. Mm-hmm. So that's why people are like shocked, oh, what's going on right now? But I always keep repeating, but all that you're seeing now, it's taking place for the last 22 years. This is nothing new. It's the only difference is that you're realizing it right now. But the signature, it's the same.
Is that the reason that the movie Quo Vadis, Aida, and this specific scene with the Dutch former commander Karremans is so striking? Because maybe you can describe the scene for the listeners who don't know the scene and why you were using it.
Yeah, it's kind of really tragic, but somehow also an absurd scene because, it's about the tragedy of Srebrenica, and he is realizing, this general commander, he is realizing that the men are coming and there will be like a slaughterhouse soon. And he's trying to find help and calling like different authorities. And it's summer, it's August, and he's completely like left alone with this tiny army. And he keeps calling and calling, and somebody's answering that the guy he's trying to get in touch with, he's on vacation. And this is so brutal and so kind of really, sarcastic and so deeply ironic. I mean, it's about like thousands of people that are going to be killed and somebody's on a beach and doesn't want to be disturbed.
Yeah, while someone is desperately in need. And in this case, feels responsible for thousands of lives.
Of course. I mean, I like about that movie that it's not like as black as white or as simple, because you can also see that he is completely, he feels, how to express it. He's in need, and he's desperate and he doesn't know what to do because, and he's also afraid. Yeah. He's also a human being, and he knows that he is never going to resist these guys.
Quite interesting and ironic, actually, that the West was on a holiday for many years. Mm-hmm. And after the full-scale Russian invasion in Ukraine, but especially after the Russians left Kiev Oblast, and from the moment it was possible to visit Kiev and Zelensky again, all the Western European leaders stood in line to enter Ukraine by train and to shake the hands with the new leader of the world. That was kind of ironic compared to what you were saying right now.
Yeah, somehow. it's interesting what you're saying. I didn't know about that, but yeah, somehow it is, yeah.
If we talk about, Jan says that now Western European leaders visited Zelensky, the months before the war started, I spoke with Ukrainians and they already saw some changing behavior, because in 2014 they went to Moscow only and didn't visit Kiev at all and just spoke via Moscow. Poroshenko has to deal with it. But now the Ukrainians said, well, they also went to Kiev to talk with Zelensky. And sometimes they went even before, first to Kiev, then to Moscow. So they already saw some changing in behavior. Or is it just, what was it, a political...
But it took 20 years.
It took 20 years, yes.
I don't know, I think the paradigm is changing. And it became impossible to not to... How to say that? I mean, he became like a modern hero. Mm-hmm. So it's... It's impossible to ignore that. And in the beginning, there were like a lot of narratives and people keep repeating, yes, but he's like, he was not such a good politician and he didn't do such a good work before. And it's only now. And he's like using the situation for himself and so on and so on. But after some weeks and months, it became kind of, it was not possible to ignore it anymore. Mm-hmm. And everyone like admiring and expressing their respect. So I think, of course, it's also political decision to stand on the right side. Mm-hmm. But it's funny, and yeah, I agree. It's kind of ironic that it changed like this way in 6 months or 5 months, and before it was Moscow mm-hmm. was like much more important, and now it's completely different, and a lot of things changed. I mean, even like the Green Party in Germany, and it was not imaginable even 1 year before that they out of sudden mm-hmm. they started to talk about reactivating this nuclear plant. Yeah, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this is what I mean. This paradigma is changing.
In this article you published, you wrote 2 weeks after the beginning of the war, you mentioned using a language. The Western countries are using a language which are people like Putin laughing about it. They don't take it seriously.
The way we read your op-ed was like, there are 2 points you're raising. Like, one is the prosperity of the West should not always be on top of the list, and we should show. And we're Dutch, so we're talking about us. The West should be more focused on solidarity, peace, and other values. And the second point that Floris is raising is you were writing about firmness, showing firmness in the language. And what did you notice 5 months after you were writing that op-ed?
Yes, it's also, I mean, I understand it, and I have a lot of left-wing friends. And of course, when we had these discussions, of course, it's everyone against war and like for human rights and so on. And of course, I would agree and I would cite everything what they're saying. But I experienced it on my own. When you're in a situation and a guy is standing in front of you with a gun, mm-hmm. you don't think about like human values and great political discussion. And in that case, you don't need any blankets and like milk powder. Mm-hmm. In that situation, you're also becoming an animal and you're thinking about how to survive and how to protect your kids or family. And in that case, you want a gun. And it doesn't. And this is something that I think Western society didn't want to hear for a long time. Also, a lot of friends of mine, because still, it was always like this, but still.
We can still try to talk.
Yeah, but my opinion is, and I'm really convinced, that in that case, even when it was not really imaginable to you before, you change, the whole world changed, because it's about like surviving. And at that point, nobody knows how one is going to react. And this really kind of liberal and nice and open-minded and human values and ideologies, you have to be able to afford them. You have to be in a quite peaceful situation, then you can talk about that, and of course. And there have been a lot of articles and a lot of people with their opinions, a lot of intellectuals here in Germany who were representing this opinion. But it makes me mad, because of course it's easier to talk about all that stuff when you're sitting on your couch and drinking your red wine and talking about that values. But you're not fleeing, you're not bombed, you're not killed, your kids are safe, and so on. So this is something I'm really convinced, and because it was the same. I was 2008, I was back there in Tbilisi, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. I experienced it. And I didn't think about like blankets and human values. And even I was afraid of my own feelings, but in that moment you only feel like hate and anger. And you're mad, and these blankets are not helping in that moment.
Has this language been changed after 5-6 months? Is there some kind of, do you see a new kind of language of Western?
I think the West is still looking for it. I don't think that we already have one. But they realized, and I'm happy about that, that the language that had been used before, it's not really... it doesn't make... I mean, maybe it makes sense, but not with with Russia.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but all those sanctions and eventually also cutting off the energy line with Russia, gas, coal, oil, delivering weapons to Ukraine as individual countries, because if it would be as NATO, we would be in trouble. That's what we say, what we think. That's already a pretty firm line. Or are you saying we should still, like the Netherlands and Germany and France, we should still be on the line of maybe Estonia, Latvia, banning all Russians, no more visa, kind of being Russophobic maybe?
It's difficult, and I'm thinking about it a lot due to Georgian situation right now. For example, we've been talking about before, Georgia has to deal with this huge problem right now, dividing the whole society because a lot of Russians are coming or fleeing to Georgia, and it's like completely overcrowded, and a lot of people, also friend of mine, are keeping repeating that one day you're not protected from that. Putin can wake up one day and saying what he's always saying, like I have to protect my citizens and like enter Georgia. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I'm not quite sure. I think politicians have to deal with that. And of course, I'm not for xenophobia. And of course, you have to always like, it's depends always on context. And you have to, of course, for people like from the oppositional parties or press or journalists who fled to Georgia, of course, I'm completely willing to give them visa, or they should stay and they should have shelter. But somehow you have to control it, yes. And,
somehow, how can you control it?
I think, for example, Georgia has to start to use visa for Russians. Mm-hmm. So you can control much better and have a look who is coming to your country. Because, of course, I'm enjoying this, like... open borders and not needing visa anymore, and I hated all my life this borders and borders and borders, but now this is like a completely different situation, and I think one have to control better, because now the problem is that because the politicians are not dealing with the situation in a proper way, the society is completely divided, and you have a lot of discussions, and it's becoming a quite emotional issue, and it's mm-hmm. not good because it's becoming an explosive matter, and you cannot deal with that in a like proper and rational way, and this is important to do so. And I think it always depends, like it's of course it's different from one country to another, and Balticum has a completely different history with Russia than like Germany or Netherlands, and it's difficult for me because I'm also not a politician, and it's difficult for me to say there is a general solution or there is a general way how to deal with that. I think it always depends, but I think it's not that bad to have a harsh, a bit becoming a bit tougher with that, and because we cannot we're not allowed to forget what is going on the other side, what's going on in the Ukraine.
Maybe before we continue talking about Georgia and your books, one more question to close this chapter. So we're trying in kind of philosophical conversations to close some kind of gap, cultural, mental, between West and East, whatever it is. But what do you think? Should we strive for one Europe? Should we strive for, of course, for the same prosperity? But also Europe is great because it has so many cultures and languages. How do you look at that? The fact that the Netherlands and Ukraine is getting closer to each other, but still has differences.
These differences will always will be, and I don't think that it's as bad, because, I mean, yes, this is what I really love about Europe, this diversity and these different cultures. But I think we should strike for like more respect and like better understanding for each other. And we should maybe overcome this arrogance. This is what I really don't like about the Western cultures, mm-hmm. because it's somehow always like in this article I mentioned, this from this Polish writer, he's also talking about that. And I couldn't forget that after I read it, that he's mentioning that some things that were completely not imaginable for the Western cultures or countries, it's completely okay for the East and from the Western perspective. And this is something that I think it has to change, because if we want to be equals, then we have to go this equal way. And for example, what I mean, and I do believe that it's the same what he is talking about. For example, I remember quite well, it was 2002, I guess, or three, maybe even four. I think it was 2003 or four. The tragedy of
das Land Nordost?
No. Beslan.
Beslan. Mm-hmm. Was in 2004.
I guess. And I was so shocked about what the Western press were writing about that. I mean,
it was Beslan was about the gijzeling in English?
Hostage.
Hostage of a school
in
North Ossetia.
It was North Ossetia. And some Chechen guys, mm-hmm. They went into a school.
Mm-hmm,
And hosted it, I don't know. I mean, 350 people, most of them kids, were killed mm-hmm. in that special operation, as the Russians called it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so shocked. I remember I was a student, and I imagined how it would be if this kind of tragedy would happen in Germany or in France or in Netherlands or in Denmark. And I mean, the Western press, it was like, okay, it's quite terrible and such a big tragedy, but
far away.
Yeah. So what should one say? And there have been no harsh reacting about what Russia did.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, it was already Putin, and he was just like, no, we're not dealing with terrorists, so just enter. And
but in our case, not even MH17, the downing of the plane with almost 200 Dutch victims, was giving the same response as we see right now.
Yeah. It's also a good example. So I think already back then you could see that, okay, we don't want any troubles with you. So just like do your stuff. And yeah, it's a pity and it's a terrible thing, because more than 300 children were killed. And this is what I mean. If something like that happened in any of the Western countries, I mean, that would be a revolution. The political party would completely change, and people mm-hmm. because it's like unimaginable, such a big tragedy. But people were completely like forgotten, and yeah, just go on. So this is what I do believe. This is what he means when he writes that things that are kind
Stefan
of not really thinkable, not even imaginable in the West, it's okay for the East. And this is something that I do believe has to change, because if we want like the same values and we want this kind of Europe with all the diversities, and of course there will be these cultural differences, but it's not as bad. Why? It's okay. But I think it's not good if we still have this we have to overcome this arrogance here.
En dan is daar nog de welvaart. Haratischvili spreekt zich niet echt uit of in het Westen er nou klaar voor zijn om iets minder welvaart te accepteren. Om de prijs te betalen voor wat Rusland in diverse landen in haar regio doet. Maar Haratischvili is er wel van overtuigd dat als Oost-Europa de rijkdom en voorsprong zou hebben van West-Europa, dat ook die regio net zo egoïstisch zou reageren.
One thing I really do believe is that it's not about that Eastern people are somehow better than the Western. If Eastern people were in the same situation, they would do the same. I really do believe. It's a human good condition. It's completely human that we are not. This is why socialism didn't work. And it will never work out because as the human beings, we are always like striving for better life, more wealth for us, for our families. And this idea of we are all brothers and sisters, it's somehow nice, but it doesn't work in reality, unfortunately. Because, of course, it's a great idea, but it's not like a part of human nature.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it takes one more, 1,000 years of evolution, and maybe one day we can achieve this humana condition. But right now we're not as far. So yeah, and this property issue. I think it's not about that. Now we have to completely change our lifestyle, and we have to like. The Western people should feel guilty and so on. We're in a capitalistic system, and this is a completely different issue. But now it's about like, okay, do I want my comfort and staying in my comfort zone, though I know that people are killed for that? Or am I kind of ready to pay my price? And last 3-4 months I've been touring around with my book, and this book is about 90s in Georgia, and like for 10 years we didn't have gas, we didn't have even electricity, and it was a terrible time, and nobody missed it, nobody wants it back, but we've survived. And I'm always keeping repeating into Germans, so we've survived, we have this experience, so we can make some workshops for you. So don't be afraid, because you don't want to have like a warm apartment, a flat, if it does mean that somebody's going to die for that. And this is something that I do believe that 90% of Germans, Dutch or French people doesn't want.
Met Nino Haratischvili, Georgisch schrijver, woonachtig in Berlijn.
In dit deel van het gesprek gaat het over de Georgische kloof tussen de politici en het volk. En het optimisme en de hoop in haar boeken, ondanks al het verdriet, leed en de gruwelijkheden waarover ze schrijft.
I was able to read some parts of your new book. And was fascinating because you're talking about something that you were used to in the 90s, although it wasn't a nice thing. I was also thinking now about the scene of queuing, people standing in line, and you're writing about Europeans who are standing in line in a very decent way. On the other hand, in Georgia and other parts in Eastern Europe, of course. Queuing was kind of a lifestyle, gossiping, arranging everything. It's another difference, but it was popping up because it was a very interesting scene to read about and think about right now. But still, your book. I mean, you wrote it, of course, before the full-scale invasion in Ukraine. Nevertheless, so much stuff happened for the last 14 years. That there was a lot to reflect on, because part of your book is about reflection, right? So these elements from current affairs, how much are they intertwined in your book? So the basics is about the 90s, of course, but then in 2019, if I'm correct, everyone is in Brussels and you're reflecting. And is there some, are there elements of current affairs, of current Russian aggression also in the book that you...
When I was working on writing this book, of course, I could not imagine things would come this way. And somehow it left a kind of bad taste in my mouth, because since it's been published, I've been talking like almost all the time about the politics and Russia and so on. And this was not my main goal, of course. But I had a feeling that people were coming to these readings and these events and were like, they had a lot of questions and I could understand. And I was trying to explain, but after a while I also felt a bit weird, because I'm not in the Ukraine and still I have, it's like my own quite individual perspective, and my experience is like, still there is a difference. Of course, you have a lot of parallels between Georgia and Ukraine and problems mm-hmm. with Russia, but still it's, you have to, there are differences. And then I kind of stopped a bit because, yeah, I felt a bit weird. I was thinking that this book is kind of, it has a profit from this current situation.
To gain a profit.
And I didn't like it. But for me, it was, I wanted to write about my youth, my childhood period. It's not like an autobiographical book, but still a lot of memories. And these are collective memories, because I'm sharing it with almost everyone who lived in Georgia back then. And I'm a bit younger than the main characters in that book. They're like 10 years older. And I'm really thankful that I was so young, because... the whole situation I only realized after moving to Germany, because I was too young to understand what was going on. I mean, the whole picture. Of course, I was part of it, but somehow my childhood and, of course, my parents and my family protected me from the awareness of what was going on. And I wanted to reconstruct that period, yes, that time. And it's about memories, but... first of all, I wanted to write a book about friendship. It's about four friends meeting after many years in present days in Brussels at an exhibition, and reconstructing and remembering and memorizing all that, what was going on. And of course, there are like a lot of painful memories. And it was an effort to try to understand how it all could happen, all this violence and all this deconstruction and all this anger and all that hate and brutality, what was going on back then, and this really pervert, masculine, crazy, unhealthy, ideology and... wars, of course, also how it could happen in that short period. It was like 10, 13, 14 years maximum, and all that happened. And sometimes when I'm talking about that, and I didn't talk for a lot of years about that period, not with my German friends, but when I started to talk, it seemed to me that it sounds like a Hollywood movie.
Mm. Because with gangs and mafia,
but I know
wars,
it's and
a
I
knew, movie.
Yeah, kind of trash movie. I don't know, Tarantino, like Eastern Tarantino.
Oh, Tarantino, that's a good one.
Yeah, like a really Eastern Tarantino, and somehow I could not even imagine, because historically it's a short while. It's only like 20 mm-hmm. years.
Yeah.
And
between end of 80s and beginning of the zeros.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you said you couldn't talk about it with your German friends or at all?
No, with my German friends, because I had this feeling, and I don't know why, I did believe that they could not understand it. Mm-hmm. They could not even imagine it. I've been always talking about that with my Georgian friends, and even with my Georgian friends here, because it's impossible for people who lived during that period not to be kind of traumatized. And we always, remembered, but it was always with a spin, with a laughter, you know, we've been always also laughing a lot about that. I think it's also a way to deal with that when things are so terrible that you have to laugh to survive somehow and not lose your mind. But still, I was more lucky than, for example, the generation of my parents. Because, I mean, they were young, but still they were also adults, and they had the awareness of what was going on. And I think that was really, really, really difficult to deal with that.
Shall we talk more to Georgia and the Georgian part of the story?
Of course.
Yes?
Yeah.
We see that the West is showing, or at least showed, solidarity with Ukraine. Is there still room left to show solidarity to other countries who are in need and under threat as well, like Georgia? Or do you see not so much European solidarity with your country as it is now with Ukraine?
I mean, Georgia has not this existential trouble right now as the Ukraine. And of course, it's more important that Europe shows solidarity with one who is in such a great need right now as the Ukraine.
Quite symbolic that we hear ambulances while talking about a country in need. Yeah. Say it again, sorry.
But, for example, like back 2008, it was a different reaction. Of course, a lot of Western politicians, they came and they tried to,
to show compassion, to show solidarity.
To negotiate.
Yeah, negotiate and help and so on. And
like Sarkozy.
But of course, it was kind of forgotten after some weeks or months. And I think this, and it's not only about Georgia, and it starts with Abkhazia and Ossetia and Chechnya. I mean, Chechnya, the last war, it lasted 10 years. Can you imagine? It's really crazy. And there's nothing in that country that is left. It's completely, I've been there, and it's so terrible and so sad. And I cannot even imagine how this tiny, tiny, tiny country with small people could resist for so long. It's really unimaginable. And now if you go there, it's like everything is like, set design. It feels like in Truman Show, nothing
is... How Grozny is built up.
Yeah, nothing is like authentic. No. It's like a facade, and and people are living in fear, and they're not allowed to talk about what happened. And if you go to the historical museum, the last war that is mentioned is the Second World War. But people, I mean, everyone who lives there was kind of course, traumatized by that war, and so many people killed, and so many people still missing, and so on. But it's also, they're not even allowed to talk about it. But it's kind of, it never happened. And it's so brutal, and it's so ironic, and so, I don't know, so all that is going on for so long, and, but... It's been forgotten. If you have a look at some books or articles from Anna Politkovskaya, everything what's going on now, it's there. You can read it. Everything, really. And it's kind of prophetic, this text is. But nobody listened. Or, okay, they listened. Even if they listened, it was just like, okay, it's far, far away. And... Georgia was also kind of far away, yes, of course. And course, now it's like more important for the every Western country, or I mean, everyone in the world, to stand beside the Ukraine, mm-hmm. and because it's a completely different situation right now. But of course, it's I mean, when the war in the Ukraine started, it's understandable that like the Balticum and even Poland and Georgia, of course, they were totally afraid. And in Georgia, still this have this fear, because we have this problem with this creeping border. It's
you mean the situation in southern Ossetia, that the
how
do you say
it? The border is like it's sweeping inside. I mean, the Russians, they're cutting off the mm-hmm. territory. And there have been even such crazy situations, like a farmer who has his own house and garden, and one day he wakes up and his garden is like on the Russian side and this house on Georgian side. The stories are happening. So this Russian threat, it never stopped in Georgia, and this fear, it's always present and always there. It's the same like with the Baltic countries, I mm-hmm, guess. Mm-hmm. So countries who have their own relationships and experiences with Russia, of course, they're reacting completely in a different way. And somehow also Georgia, and I think they all would appreciate, of course, to get some more support. But I think now it's much more important to support the Ukraine.
Yeah, but meanwhile, we are seeing in Georgia a lot of political turbulence and also frustration, maybe, after Moldova and Ukraine received this European Union
candidacy option.
Yeah. And Georgia not. Do you think that the European Union at the moment should have granted this status also to Georgia, or is Georgia now...
I mean, of course, I would love to, and I would wish Georgia to enter the European Union one day, but somehow I knew that it would not happen right now, and I guess most of people knew that, because, and now it's not like the Western fault, it's like our own failure. Mm-hmm.
From politicians, because
of course
there are so many pro-European Georgians, citizens.
Of course, because now we have a really difficult situation, because the politicians and the Georgian Dream Party, they're not representing the society anymore. So that's why we had this big riots in the beginning of the war, while the party was trying to kind of find a collaborational way, and people got so mad, and I understand it, because you cannot cooperate with the occupant. Mm-hmm. You're 20% of Georgian territory is still occupied by Russia. And you cannot find a good compromise in that situation. Of course, I understand Georgia is a small country and has no like big army or some. And of course, it's kind of ridiculous to stand in front of Russia and threat them or somehow. Yeah, but it's about I think even. Honor or even some it's about the values you're standing up mm-hmm. or standing for
sovereignty
and yeah. of course and yeah but one good thing is that, and it gives me hope, that really big part of society, and especially the young generations, they're so towards West, and they're so much like for these values, for the European values, and they know, they also have this awareness that they that every part of the society counts, and everyone has to change and has to be like work on it, because even my generation, and this is a Soviet heritage, It was always like, you know, you have this big high instance somewhere like Kremlin or a political party, and you as a human being or part of society, you doesn't count. It was always like, just forget it, you cannot change it anyway. Mm-hmm. And this has changed. And I think it's a really, really, really big step towards that values and this way of life. But quite now, it's a big, big problem because there is such a big gap between the Georgian politics and politicians and the society.
I have a final question.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Shoot.
Because I've read The Eight Life for Brilka. I've read Cats in the General. I've been able to read some parts of your new book, Lack of Light.
Which will be published
in Dutch.
In Dutch, in the beginning of November, Het Schaarse Licht.
Schaarste van Licht.
Schaarste van Licht.
Yeah. And the books are great. History is sad. Full of misery. Still, there is a smile, of course, sometimes. And I was just wondering, because you're writing about Georgia, about Chechnya, about Russian aggression, is there somehow in your mind some room or space or optimism or hope for to write about a positive future of Georgia, maybe, or a generation that is having a life without too many, with less misery? Are you thinking about that sometimes?
I think especially The Eighth Life and also the last one, The Lack of Light, for me, both of the endings are hopeful still. Of course, there's a lot of misery and a lot of sadness and a lot of darkness in both of that books because this is how it was. Mm-hmm. This is what the history was like. And it's not like only my pervert imagination. And when people are sometimes complaining about why do you have to be so harsh and there are so many brutal scenes, and I'm always answering that it's not like my vision. Of course, it's my fantasy, but I'm inspired by real events. I'm inspired by real history. But still, I don't think that it's completely hopeless. And in the end of The Eighth Life, the book ends with an empty page. So history keeps writing itself. And of course, history also keeps repeating, but there are also a lot of changes. And human beings are also able to change for better. I do believe so. Understand some things and become aware and the same with The Lack of Light. I mean, there are a lot of painful memories, but in the end, they're also kind of, they overcame it, and they're in present, and they're right now and right then, and they're together. And of course, it's not this classical kind of happy end, but I do believe that there is hope, because otherwise I could not write, and it would not make sense. This is not my intention to like sit down and make everyone depressed. I think it's important to know what's behind us, to be aware of what's going on in our present, and maybe also somehow have some goals for the future. And I mean, it sounds a bit like a fairy tale, I know, but I don't feel this hopeless. And also, of course, I pity a lot of characters of my books with their really terrible and tough lives and big challenges and this really cruel destiny. But there are also a lot of fighting and a lot of trying and a lot of even, also love, I think. And I don't know. I couldn't write about future because I'm not trying. I'm not writing science fiction, and I cannot. I don't know what is going to be in 10 years. And it's of course always easier to write about what already happened than what is going to happen. But for example, I mean, if we talk about Georgia, I'm really, really hopeful when I look at the young generations. They're different, and they don't have the Soviet heritage and this this kind of mentality. They're different, the generations who already been born in independent Georgia, and it gives me hope, yes, because I think, okay, this has to pass. We have to go on, and we have to
you have to go deal through this
process. Mm-hmm. Yes, of course, and it's painful, and of course it's difficult because, I mean, since I was born, there is no peace, no, just like it's impossible to have this kind of stable and quiet life. It's always something's happening and something's going on and a lot of problems and a lot of troubles been not solved by any of the parties and any of the politicians. But still, things are developing, time is changing, and society, yeah, it became more and more like unite. I don't know how to say that, but I think there is hope. There is always hope.
That's always a good sentence to end with. You can pronounce the name again. I can say thank you, Nino.
Thank you, Nino Haratishvili.
Thank you
for this interview.
We're looking forward to see you in the Netherlands.
And to read your book in Dutch also.
I'm really excited, yes. It's they're translating it right now. And in November is the book launch. And then I'll be touring around.
En dat was het uitgebreide gesprek met Nino Haratishvili. Onze zesde en laatste Perestroika-gast deze zomer.
Wil je de eerdere gesprekken uit onze zomerserie terugluisteren? Met bijvoorbeeld de Albanese premier Edi Rama over zijn bijzondere relatie met Mark Rutte. Het gesprek met Casper Veldkamp over zijn voorkennis met de Russische invasie. En Robert Serri, oud-diplomaat, over de wederopbouw van Oekraïne en hoe Europees Oekraïners zijn. Kijk dan op bnr.nl/perestroikast of in je favoriete podcast-app.
Intussen gaan we gewoon door met onze reguliere podcast. Met veel aandacht voor de situatie in Oekraïne en Rusland. Check ons gesprek ook met Rusland-correspondent Joost Bosman over Alexander Dugin.
Aito.
Paka.
BNR Headlines. De hele dag binnen- en buitenlandse politiek.
In Nederland hebben we geen munitiefabrieken.
De hele dag economie.
5 dagen in de week bezorgen. Dat kan niet uit.
De hele dag technologie.
Amerikanen weer op de maan.
Heb je eigenlijk geen tijd, maar wil je toch op de hoogte blijven? BNR Headlines. Het laatste nieuws, maar dan in het kort. Ga naar je podcast-app en abonneer je op BNR Headlines.